Support for this podcast comes from Planned Parenthood. It's hard to imagine a world where we leave future generations with fewer rights and freedoms. Since the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills aimed at blocking people from getting the essential sexual and reproductive care they need, including abortion. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves access to care. And with supporters like you, they can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future to learn more and support their cause.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Hey guys, my guest today, Andrew Ujifusa, is somebody who I have been wanting to have on the show for a long time. We actually worked together a long time ago, now back in college on the school paper. I was the editor in chief. He was a sports editor. We are not talking about sports today. He's now a great education journalist. And we had a conversation that's about the critical race theory debate. Most of the coverage of this I've seen has either gone like way off into the academic weeds, talking about like critical race theory scholars, or it's gotten super political, looking at sort of Republican Party tactics and their machinations. Andrew, really it helps us understand in this conversation what is actually happening inside schools and school systems, what the pressures are on educators, what parents' concerns are, and what implications all of this has for kids and for society, what really matters here, and frankly, the extent to which it maybe doesn't matter so much compared to some other things. We got a little wide ranging at the end, but I think that's what's always good in these kind of conversations. So here we go. Check it out. Andrew Ujifusa. Welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias. My guest today, Andrew Ujifusa, is an assistant editor at Education Week. He covers Congress, sort of federal politics in an education context, is here with me today to talk about critical race theory, which I understand you've been speaking to a lot of people about these days. Folks seem very interested in this subject. It's blown up, right?
Yes, they're very interested. They have strong feelings, you could say, about that topic and related topics.
And so when we say that people are getting interested in critical race theory, when I was in college, I was a philosophy major. We had some class and we read some excerpts from Derek Bell's book, Faces from the Bottom of the Well. And we read someone, I think Matsuda's like critique of Supreme Court free speech jurisprudence. But I take it that that is not really what they're talking about, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I think like a lot of things in politics, you look for terms that capture sort of a broader universe of what you're concerned about, right? And some of this deals with efforts in schools to address issues around equity, diversity, and inclusion. Like, how do we incorporate different perspectives into lessons about history? How do we make sure we're considering different factors, different historical forces that, maybe are outside the quote unquote mainstream that may be informative for students? And some of it deals with that. Some of it, just deals with national politics and how people perceive at least that that is impacting what schools do, from classroom teachers to school administrators, which I think in some cases is an important distinction to make. But I think that there are various different forces at work, and critical race theory has sort of become this catch-all term for different concerns that people have about what schools are doing.
Right, because I sometimes see liberals being very, like they're doing a term paper and kind of being like, well, that's not what critical race theory is, right? But this is like a catch-all term for the idea that there have been changes to educational practice over the past 1, 5, 20 years that have something to do with racial equity, and people who object to some or all of that. They want a phrase for it, right? Like, if you're trying to, like, do politics, it's, like, useful to have a label for the people that you're arguing with.
Yes, I think there have been shifts in classroom practice. And, you know, I think in the past, as you put it, 5, 10, 20 years, there's been an increasing focus on equity in policy and sort of broader policy as we think about it in terms of what the federal government focuses on. You can find that, and if you wish, everything like No Child Left Behind to approaches the federal government takes to civil rights issues. So yes, I think this has become something where people find it a useful way to talk about things, not just in classroom practice, but in policy in the federal government, which is obviously easier to quote unquote politicize in ways that are useful for people who are looking for leverage.
But so this is an interesting distinction. I mean, we did an episode on this show sort of looking back at No Child Left Behind recently.
I listened to it. I enjoyed it very much.
Oh, there you go. So, you know, in the NCLB era, there was a lot of talk about the achievement gap and even some rhetoric to the effect of this was the civil rights issue of our time. And if you look at like the formal properties of that, that is a discussion of racial equity. But it's like different groups of people using different terms and espousing different ideas, even as on some level they're talking about the same thing, right?
I think that's right. They are talking about the same general thing in terms of like, how do we address these inequities in society and in schools? What are those inequities? There are different types of inequities, of course, ranging from academic achievement to civil rights, and how do we address them, right? So different movements of these sorts tend to be working, you know, often behind the scenes or not very prominently for a long time. And then they suddenly come into public view and capture public attention. And I think what you're describing sort of happened with No Child Left Behind, where, you know, obviously you had very powerful government officials working on this stuff. So it wasn't just some sort of stealth movement where nobody knew what was going on. But as you guys discussed on that episode, it dates back to A Nation at Risk, that report from the 1980s that sort of raised anxiety about American schools and their how much they were helping the nation in terms of economic competitiveness. I think it might be illegal actually for education reporters to discuss this stuff without mentioning A Nation at Risk. But, you know, various forces combined with that and different people worked on it on a bipartisan basis to produce No Child Left Behind. And the idea, which I think still holds a fair amount of sway on Capitol Hill if you talk to powerful Democrats, is that you have to shine a light on this stuff. Without that light, if you take that flashlight away of, you know, sort of accountability and assessments, these black and brown students are going to suffer. They're going to be neglected. So yeah, that was one way that folks talked about educational equity. But as you said, this is a very different moment. And not all of that is due to sort of No Child Left Behind fatigue. You know, that law was revised, gosh, about 6 years ago now, so 2015. So we're kind of past that, but I think that fatigue has something to do with it.
Well, and then this is where I think there's a turn, right? Because as No Child Left Behind is happening, as all this testing is happening, there are various strands of criticism of that. And one strand, I think, is in a meaningful way informed by academic critical race theory, which is to say that it's wrong to like blame schools or teachers and like say, oh, you're not doing a good enough job to teach kids, but to say that no, that this is structural racism, right? This is like a bigger fact of our society that we are seeing here. Or even Ibram Kendi makes the striking claim that like the idea of an achievement gap is a racist idea, that this is like an excuse to not give black adults full opportunity in society. And so you have a conversation that's also about racial equity, but it's a different conversation from the like testing and accountability conversation.
Yeah. So I think if you talk to a lot of people who supported No Child Left Behind and things like that, they say the reason we have these assessments is to shine a light. And then, but the point isn't just to shine a light. It's to say, here's what these students need. States and districts to get involved. There's a certain amount of trust involved in that, but it's not total trust in just saying you can do whatever you want, educators and states, because then we wouldn't need these tests. But shine a light We'll give you resources that we think are adequate or sufficient, and then you have to do something about it, right? We want to see improvement. And I think the argument that you just described, which takes a very different view, is yes, these tests reveal something, but they don't lead to anything productive, and that they almost act as like a shaming device for Black and brown kids and their communities as to all the challenges they face that have been put in place by American society in general. And so there was a strand of that. I think, as you've indicated, it's become more prominent. You know, again, I don't want to overstate the power of that view, which has gotten more prominence. If you talk to folks in Congress, you know, I don't think anyone would describe Patty Murray or Bobby Scott as right-wing or anything like that. But if you talk to them, that you will not convince them that those tests are not important, that they view those tests as a civil rights measure, as a civil rights tool. And that view isn't so trendy right now, but it's still prevalent among some people in power.
And that's where, you know, it gets challenging to sort of get your arms around some of this larger conversation about, I don't know what you want to call it exactly, but like, I don't know, like left-wing stuff in schools, which is that, what, there's like 100,000 schools in America? And then each of them has like lots of different people working in them. There's like lots of stuff happens in education, and you can completely fill your Twitter feed or some articles somewhere with unrepresentative items if you want to. I like read a lot of stuff about like parents and board meetings and, you know, like this.
Okay.
This chum that's out there. But then I also like, I have a child in public school in an urban district, and reality is just like much more normal than the news coverage is. And yet if I go hunting to be like, okay, like what is in, you know, if I go to the DCPS website, then there's an equity framework protocol. And then it has like this footnote here with a link to the continuum on becoming an anti-racist multicultural institution. And I could like screenshot like the weirdest thing that's on that page and be like, this is what DCPS is doing. And, you know, probably like go to a Manhattan Institute event, but like also just like as a parent at DCPS, like that's not really what the school is like.
Well, so this is the power of the anecdote, right? And as you just described with tens of thousands of schools, there are so many anecdotes, right? Or potential anecdotes. So, you know, let me throw a couple numbers at you. So in the midst of all this interest or controversy, whatever you want to call it, you know, Education Week, we did a nationally representative survey about how educators, you know, like teachers and principals in public schools feel about this stuff in general. And what we found was that about a third said, you know, certain conversations about sexism and racism, the type of stuff that these, you know, quote unquote, anti-critical race theory bills deal with, are not appropriate for schools, you know, to engage with or deal with. They're sort of taking the side of those state lawmakers. I don't want to make the link too strong there. And 59%, they believe systemic racism exists in American society. Now that's a majority, but it's not like 95%, right? So I think educators have lots of different thoughts on this stuff. And it's easy to characterize public school teachers as, you know, sort of these left-wing types that are just only too eager to incorporate all these ideas from academia that are decades old. But I think, as you indicate, it's more complicated than that in a way that might defy stereotypes.
Right. I mean, you know, there's a lot of public school teachers in America, right? So it can like both be true that they are on average to the left of the median voter, while there's also an incredible diversity of people working in public schools and things that they think about stuff.
Yes, exactly. And in 2017, we did a similar survey of educators, not just teachers, but educators in general. And we found that about 30% voted for Trump. So again, you don't want to say that like none of these people voted for Trump, and you don't want to say a lot of them did necessarily. So it's more complicated than the partisans on this stuff want to admit. And that's sort of one of the arguments that you hear essentially is when educators are saying, hey, we don't teach critical race theory, which, you know, people have various responses to, and there's more to say about it than just leaving it at that. But they're sort of saying, hey, we're not doing the sort of outlandish stuff that, as you were indicating, people can cherry pick from websites or whatever. Like that's, this is a little simplistic, but they're saying, hey, we're doing normal stuff. Like this is, we're doing stuff that you know, parents are largely familiar with, you know, when they think about history class or whatever.
Right. Okay, let's take a break, and then I want to come back to the other side of that question.
Support for this podcast comes from Planned Parenthood. Your body is your own. That's why Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Today, lawmakers who oppose abortion are challenging Planned Parenthood. Affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. Planned Parenthood believes that health care is a basic human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies. They also work tirelessly to oppose the onslaught of new policies aimed at interfering with personal decisions best left to patients and their doctors. They won't give up and they won't back down. You can join Planned Parenthood in the fight to help make sure that the next generation can decide their own futures. The organization needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, they can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future to learn more and support their cause. Support for this podcast comes from Planned Parenthood. Your body is your own. That's why Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Today, lawmakers who oppose abortion are challenging Planned Parenthood. Affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. Planned Parenthood believes that health care is a basic human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies. They also work tirelessly to oppose the onslaught of new policies aimed at interfering with personal decisions best left to patients and their doctors. They won't give up and they won't back down. You can join Planned Parenthood in the fight to help make sure that the next generation can decide their own futures. The organization needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, they can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future to learn more and support their cause.
So then an issue that, I mean, I know a lot of parents who I know who are less engaged in this debate have is, well, if the argument is like we're not, in fact, doing anything weird, what do these laws actually say or do that merits pushback? I mean, you know, like it would be strange for the state of Tennessee to like ban bringing live elephants into public schools. But also fine, right? Because, like, nobody's doing that, right?
Unless the circus is in town, yeah.
Sure, yeah, you know, I don't know. You know, you can make fun of somebody for, like, getting into hysteria about something that's fake, but you could also be, like, upset that somebody is passing a law that's pernicious and is going to force drastic changes that you think are bad. There's a lot of states and a lot of laws, but a lot of the ones that I've seen, they're like, okay, we need to stop critical race theory. And by critical race theory, we mean saying that all white people are inherently evil. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, they're probably not saying that in school. Like, who cares?
Well, so let's return to what these laws say. And I want to be careful because...
Let's be careful. Careful is good.
Careful is excellent. So, you know, I want to draw a distinction, for example, between how laws treat how students should feel or certain actions they should take, for example, or certain declarations they should make. I think that it's one thing, some of these laws say, like, you know, students shouldn't be compelled to make certain declarations or take certain actions in the classroom about how I'm a white male, so therefore I'm part of the oppressor class. And if I'm someone else, I'm part of the oppressed class. You know, and I don't think that there would be a lot of objection in isolation to the idea that students shouldn't be compelled to do those things that, you know, would obviously make many, if not all of them, feel uncomfortable. And they would come home and say, hey, I had to do this thing and I don't understand why. And then parents would get very upset. I think the more pertinent issue is how some of the laws deal with concepts that they view as divisive, you know, and not about student actions or declarations they have to make, but, you know, just sort of these concepts in history that sort of, hey, that sort of subverts American ideals, and so we don't want that in our schools. That's sort of the message in some of these bills. I should say that, you know, for example, Oklahoma has passed, I think, a relatively sweeping version of this so-called anti-CRT stuff that a lot of people are concerned about. But the law also says this law can't be construed to, you know, sort of subvert the state's history standards, sort of the content standards. And so one of those history standards, as we and others have reported, is, hey, you have to teach students about the race riot, the awful racist massacre in Tulsa in 1921. So, you know, a teacher might say, okay, I have this law on the books about, you know, divisive concepts and stuff, but then I have to deal with teaching students about Tulsa. That's potentially difficult. I think, you know, we talked to educators in Oklahoma who are concerned about that. And then there's also the potential for folks to willfully or not sort of misinterpret what these laws cover. There's been controversy in recent days about, you know, parents sort of picking up on an anti-CRT or whatever you want to call it law and saying, hey, we don't like Ruby Bridges and her situation being taught in schools. And so, you know, are Republican lawmakers in that state going to step in and say, no, no, that's not what we meant. That's going too far. I mean, maybe not. I don't know. We'll see. But I think there's confusion that's being created intentionally or not on that end, too.
Right. Because part of this is that there's like a broad spectrum of parents in the school system. It's hard to make a curriculum choice that's not going to like annoy somebody. Like I had one dad who was like, I don't know why exactly he was so fired up about this, but like he really felt that some Black History Month thing was like exaggerating George Washington Carver's achievements in agronomy. And I was kind of like, I don't know, man. Like, who cares? This is just like what you do in February.
Well, that may be a little more obscure than some of the other issues we're dealing with, but okay.
No, right. But I just mean, it's like such a banal thing and such a like commonplace of education. And, you know, look, it's like you're trying to have a diverse, you're trying to show people there's like role models in all kinds of fields and, you know, blah, 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 blah. But then like, I don't know, this guy, he's like up on his high horse about it. And it is like probably good that there isn't some legislative hook that like random cranks can turn things into a big case out of. On the other hand, like I was digging through the footnotes of the DCPS equity framework, and it's like if you follow enough links, you get to the continuum on becoming an anti-racist multicultural organization, where at the highest phase of anti-racism, you actively work in larger communities to eliminate all forms of oppression. And it's not that like anyone's going to say oppression is good, but what is definitely true is that you have people with left-wing political commitments sort of reading that into like, here's what we have to do to be tolerant and inclusive. And you can just like, you can see why that doesn't work. Like, I don't know, like these are public institutions in conservative states. And it just seems almost inevitable to me that like, they're going to have to reflect the worldview of the people who live in Oklahoma.
Yes, these are in some sense, it's accurate to call these systems a bureaucracy. And if you read what Christopher Rufo has said, who is very closely linked to, you know, these anti-critical race theory efforts, he has said, look, one of my main aims here is to sort of change how these bureaucracies think and how they work. I don't know if subvert them is the right term. And so schools, in one view, are these bureaucracies that if they're not representative of the people in a state, and education is a state function, we don't have a federal or national school system and all that stuff, then I think that's part of what's going on here. I want to raise a couple things. Maybe one way to think about this is to look at another policy that people aren't bringing up with respect to critical race theory a lot, but it's police in schools. Let's talk about that for a second. So many years ago, I don't think in Washington, at least, and probably lots of other places too, I don't think it was especially controversial, the idea that you would have school resource officers policing schools. I don't want to say that no one was opposed to it. I think there were concerns about it, but it wasn't like this hot button political issue. And there were folks in the teachers' unions who supported it. But now, I think due to what's happened in the last few years, there's a lot of pushback among Democrats in Washington and elsewhere to police in schools. Some of that is the work of longtime activists, but the view has basically become in many circles like, hey, these police officers represent a threat to the safety of Black and Brown students in many cases. And so we want them out, right? They are an exemplar in the view of these folks of systemic racism, of systemic prejudice that hurts Black and Brown students, right? So you know, I don't want to overstate how popular that view is. I think a lot of educators support the idea of police in schools. And that gets at the idea of child safety and child protection, which is, I think, connected to what you were saying about what parents want. I think a lot of these parents are saying, you know, in varying degrees, like, hey, I don't want my child either in terms of physical safety, but also in terms of sort of the identity that, you know, they bring to school and that, you know, they bring from me and as a, you know, a member of my family and stuff. We don't want schools undermining that. We want students to be protected from those sorts of forces that threaten their identity that they get from outside of school. And that's sort of a long way of saying this is a culture war issue, right? So that's a long-winded way of sort of getting at your question. But I think those two things are helpful things for folks to think about.
But so the nationalization and centralization of this is all interesting because, you know, you were talking about, you know, conservatives see these school systems as bureaucracies that in some cases they may want to subvert or they don't like them.
In certain instances, yeah, there's a distrust.
Right. A few years ago, you know, I don't cover education full time, so I only see these things when people get fired up. I feel like the debate was like the opposite of this, right? There was this effort to create more centralized curriculum standards, and conservatives were really upset about it. And they wanted localization and autonomy. And also the more ambitious conservative ideas were like, well, there should be more school choice, right? It should be more like everybody's doing what they want. And very much not like, well, we should have like a big meeting where the state legislature is like, here's how you have to be teaching things.
Right. I think some folks have pointed out the hypocrisy of Republican state lawmakers getting together. And
I would just say a change of emphasis. No hypocrisy.
No. Well, a sort of a shifting, evolving views. So there's that out there. I think many people have made that point. But I think there you were referring to the Common Core state standards, right? So let's talk about that. So Common Core was this interesting issue where it came out of this consensus, not dissimilar consensus that drove things like No Child Left Behind, where you had school accountability, you had assessments to measure students' progress and where they stood, and then you had these standards, which are basically, it's a very dry technical subject that somehow became this national controversy, where it's like, this is what students should know and when they should know it, right? And how you get there is curriculum, that's something different. But so it was adopted by the vast majority of states and, you know, sort of enjoyed elite backing from governors and the business community. So there are a fair number of people who were influential Republicans who initially thought this was good, in addition to sort of mainstream Democrats. But, you know, as you say, that consensus sort of fell apart and conservatives associated it with the federal government. And they said, hey, this is not something that the Obama administration should be pushing or forcing down schools' throats. And, you know, I think that there are, as you know, there are plenty of supporters of school choice among people who are, I guess, left of center, right? Now, what that support for school choice looks like can vary depending on what the program is. But among some folks who are liberals, there's also sort of a distrust of the state and local educational systems that have nothing to do with the stuff that, you know, Christopher Rufo or Tucker Carlson is talking about. You know, but just sort of saying, hey, these systems are not doing right by poor Black and brown kids, so they should have more options instead of waiting for the system to be reformed. I don't know if that answers your question.
To me, it's like, I like things to be logical and, you know, have their kind of tidy boxes. And it strikes me that there's something procedurally odd about like sweeping in with laws that are like, here are things that you cannot teach. Rather than to say what I think would seem much more like natural to like normie liberals, be like, okay, we're going to have a meeting and a process. And this process is going to say, like, here are the standards for what it is that we are going to teach. And, you know, if you put together some like, here's what the history curriculum is going to look like, and that history curriculum did not include a New York Times Magazine special issue that ran in 2019, nobody would be like, well, that's crazy. You know, like, it's just a history curriculum. But when you come in one day and you're like, I want to pass a law banning the mention of this New York Times special issue, then people are like, well, that's weird. Like, that's a weird way to run a school system, right?
Well, so let me bring a bit of history to this. About 30 years ago, there was a Blue Ribbon Commission sort of put together to look at creating national history standards, like not like a federally required thing, but national history standards. And a lot of very smart, knowledgeable people involved. And one of the most prominent members was Lynn Cheney, wife of Dick, mother of Liz. And, you know, these people worked a long time on these standards. They had a lot of sort of influential backing. And then because of concerns or anger about how they treated, you know, Ulysses S. Grant versus, you know, the Red Scare under Joseph McCarthy, it all fell apart. And everyone walked away from it and said, that was terrible. That was awful. Lynn Cheney repudiated it, right? Very prominently in the Wall Street Journal. She's sort of submarined it. So I wonder what Liz Cheney today would think about the need for sort of national history standards and what people should know about history and civics. But, you know, so there's that. And there's also, we got a bit of a preview of this in a couple of instances with the Common Core when one of the authors said, you know, in discussing why he got involved with the Common Core, hey, I wanted to provide disadvantaged kids the same kind of opportunities I got as a relatively privileged white student. The same opportunities, the same access to a quality of education. And conservative media latched onto that and said, he wrote the Common Core to undermine white privilege, right? And that was sort of a little boomlet of a news story. And then also a few years ago, we had controversy over advanced placement U.S. history standards and folks expressing concerns that they were, to use a shorthand term, too negative, right, about American history. So this stuff is... it's always percolating, like it never goes away. This is just like a very explosive and very, I guess, as you've been saying, sort of odd manifestation of it. And also, like, if you look back to last year, these laws, you couldn't find them. There was a little bit of like sort of model legislation about like, hey, we don't want teachers doing left-wing ideology in school, sort of indoctrinating students. But you're right that this has sort of exploded, not out of nowhere, but just... this stuff wasn't around a year ago in terms of what state lawmakers are talking about.
We should talk about where it came from, because I think this is to the point, right? It's people are always arguing about, like, how should we talk about American history, right? Like, historians argue about it. That's, like, why they have conferences where guys with PhDs talk. And, you know, and the public argues and legislators argue. And it's usually not, like, the front burner of American politics, but it is a thing that people disagree about. But Chris Rufo... he started in the waning days of the Trump administration this big push to get a ban on what he called critical race theory in executive branch staff trainings, right? Like, that was his thing. And then after Trump left office, he pivoted this concept to state legislatures and school boards and education systems. But, like, this is new. Whereas the, like, how should we talk about America and history is old. And he very effectively put it to the front burner. And, you know, one thing, I mean, I always try to talk about with all kinds of political debates is, like, there's a mode in which people are trying to make policy changes. And they say, like, here are my concerns. And then the other side can say, well, here are my concerns. And then you can try to see, like, can we reconcile these concerns? Can we reach consensus? But we are in, like, not that mode, right? Like, this is the mode where Republican Party politicians see an advantage in pressing this. And so they welcome conflict on these points, right? Like, they don't want to lower the temperature and make incremental gains. They want to get people showing up to the meeting to, you know, ask tough questions about the superintendent.
Yes. And I think that if you look at what Trump talked about with respect to education when he entered office, it was stuff you would expect based on recent history of education. Like, hey, Common Core is bad, school choice is good. Right? Conservatives at that point were very comfortable with that message, and it was sort of what was being talked about. As you say, he left office sort of talking about, hey, we need patriotic education, and all these public schools are doing left-wing indoctrination in history class. And if you look at the language of some of these, again, so-called anti-critical race theory bills, several of them incorporate directly the language of Trump's executive order, effectively banning diversity trainings in the federal government, so that sort of stuff. So there is a pretty straight line between Trump's actual language in that executive order and these bills that I don't think should be underestimated. But yes, I think that these laws are very aggressive. Again, I don't know if the people passing them are very concerned about parsing out all the differences and how people react to them and what they think they can do under them and how they impact the work of actual classroom teachers. And you know, on the other side of the coin, you have the national teachers unions who are leaning into this, who are saying, hey, you know, we're prepared to support legal challenges of teachers who feel like these laws are improper and affecting their work in improper ways, right? I don't know if they would have done the same thing two or three decades ago. They are saying, we're going to really put our shoulder into this. We're not going to be intimidated by people we view as sort of ginning this up out of nothing and making our work hard and creating all this outrage. So, you know, I think both sides are leaning into it, even though you have Randy Weingarten, who's the president of the American Federation of Teachers, who does not shy away from fights, saying, hey, critical race theory is not a thing in K-12 schools. And again, that it's all sorts of arguments and discussions. So both sides are like saying, hey, let's fight.
Right. Let's take another break. And then I want to widen the lens a little bit.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity. But giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, that takes a team. Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else, and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Eurovision is here. This year's contest gets underway this week in Malmö, Sweden, but this year's contest comes with a dose of controversy. I'll give you one guess as to what people are mad about. Yes, correct. It's that.
Organizers of the Eurovision Song Contest say they are assessing whether Israel's entry breaks the rules on political neutrality.
I think it's a shame. I think there is no way that Israel should be able to participate in Europe.
Pro-Palestinian protesters are taking to the Swedish streets. More than 1,000 Swedish artists, including Robin, have called for an Israel ban. Some European politicians are joining them. Charlie Harding from Switched On Pop joins us this week on Today Explained to help us figure out if Europe can sing its way out of this situation.
You know, I think one thing a puzzled person might wonder about this is, like, whatever happened to, like, we should teach kids, like, I don't know, reading and math, and, you know, they should, like, do better in school. Is anybody saying in a serious way that these laws, that this controversy, one way or another, is, like, going to move the needle on, like, basic student learning outcomes that we have traditionally cared about? Like, you know, like how many, I don't know, like, are we training computer programmers? Are kids dropping out of high school? Like, basic education stuff? Is this, like, important?
I thought you might ask that question. And I remember on the Time Machine episode of No Child Left Behind, you were sort of joking at the end about, you know, being asked, like, what are schools for, right? And it's like, I don't know. What kind of a question is that, right? But, you know, I don't think the argument is really about, you know, sort of how will this help students in 10 years have a good job with a good salary, with useful skills. I don't think that's necessarily the end of the discussion, though. People like to talk about, you know, how American kids' test scores are bad or they've stagnated, and there are all sorts of reasons people can say about why that's important or not important. Usually it focuses on, like, math or English. But also, if you look at recent history, the scores on civics tests, for example, are not good, like the share of kids who can't name basic elements of the American government. is relatively high. And sometimes folks like sort of roll their eyes and are like, oh boy, you know, people think that's bad, right? But I also think it indicates that something worse is going on than just like, oh, these kids aren't being taught exactly what they should be in school. It's like, I think that has profound consequences for how they view their role as citizens. You know, as a colleague of mine put it, you know, like kids' lack of knowledge about history and civics is sometimes framed as like, well, that's a symptom of, you know, problems in society and how we don't understand how American society and government works. But, you know, what if that lack of understanding that kids have and how history classes fail them, what if that's a cause of society's, you know, broader ills and our disagreement about, you know, the direction of society? What if it's much more important for society instead of society influencing schools, right, and how poorly kids are doing on this stuff? And so if you think of it that way, and I'm not saying that's the only way to think about it or that's how people should think about it, but if you think about it that way, that history classes have a profound impact on how students as adults engage as citizens, I think that puts it in a somewhat different light. Now, I do think that there's a certain class of people who are frustrated with the idea that this is what we're focusing on right now, when the federal government has sort of taken a step back from, you know, sort of trying to direct education policy compared to several years ago. And I think those folks are also frustrated, frankly, that we're in the midst of a pandemic, and the pandemic put schools in the spotlight like never before. And, you know, I think there's a general agreement that the pandemic's impact on education is going to be quite profound, if not disastrous, for many students. And so there's a certain irony, and it's not maybe an especially funny one, but there is a certain irony that you have the pandemic and how all the attention and debate and anger it brought to schools and what to do about education. And then this issue has sort of, I don't want to say entirely superseded it, but has, you know, sort of dominated headlines recently, I think, the way the pandemic has not.
That is definitely me. I mean, this is the camp that I am in. I mean, I think the, like, do we need to reopen schools debate, like all partisan political debates in America, like often got a little crazy and a little detached from the facts. But it was about something like obviously very important, right? Like both the public health and educational outcomes sides of those school reopening controversies had really high stakes. And now I feel like whatever you made of that, we're left with a bunch of big questions about like learning loss and, you know, how can kids catch up, and continued concerns about safety and, you know, different kinds of things with like big obvious stakes. And, you know, education has always had to like fight for attention with various other issues. And now a huge share of the like general purpose education coverage has come to be about this kind of thing that the participants in the debate themselves don't seem to believe there are particularly high stakes around these kinds of issues. And yet they're like really determined to fight to the death over them. But it's like some people are going to be starting high school having not done eighth grade or half of seventh grade in person. And I don't know, like they got to learn reading.
I sense you're concerned. Yes.
It seems bad. I mean, also, you know, you talk about, you mentioned like the civics, you know, I was looking at the civics questions and, you know, there's like one, I don't know, they have a sample question and they're like asking you to explain like what Congress does, like very broadly. And it was like 50% correctly stated that Congress is the primary legislative power of the federal government. So we're talking about questions that are like much like closer to the ground than these like big abstractions. And, you know, evidently a healthy number of students are struggling at like the real basics in the civics and history space, which also seems worth talking about, perhaps more than like the outer edges of the curriculum.
That's true. I think that if you struggle with the basics, then it becomes more difficult, if not impossible, to talk about sort of these things that are more abstract, still important, but that are more abstract and help people form their understanding of American history. I will say about the school closure debate, which is still going on, that, you know, a lot of the coverage and a lot of the discussion did focus on, to get back to an earlier part of our conversation, racial inequities, you know, including how many Black and brown parents are still reluctant about the idea of just so going back to school in a normal way 5 days a week. And all the reasons that might be, I think that gets at, again, issues of trust around schools that are different than why, you know, a Republican state lawmaker might not have a great deal of trust in schools. So I think that even in coverage about that, over time, since the pandemic started here, you saw more and more of an emphasis on disparities and who was returning to school, you know, and why that might be. So I don't want to say that that debate was sort of immune from the broader sort of considerations in education that we've been talking about. And there's a lot of anger about it, you know, sort of, you know, people who want schools open are mostly privileged white parents who are pretending to speak on behalf of the interests of, you know, Black and brown parents, and, you know, all the debate about that. We don't need to get into it, but that was a play as well.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's just sort of part of my point is that, you know, it's not like the questions of racial equity that people are interested in are not implicated in these kind of bigger, more substantive things, right? But it's that, you know, I'm always frustrated, interested. You know, it's like what people love to do is like have a good political argument that doesn't require you to know anything about the specifics of the situation. And like school reopening is like a tough one. It involves like public health. It involves like parent sentiment and like understanding trust and this and that and the other thing. And it's like the more you dig into it, because like at first, my first cut on this was like, oh my God, this is terrible. Like, you know, working class Black and Latino kids are going to suffer the most from this and their parents don't have the childcare and this is so terrible. And then I started seeing the surveys and it's like, oh no, right? Like it's going the other way. It's like, those families are actually more fearful of school reopening. Their communities are suffering more from the virus. And it's like, now I'm not really sure what I should even say. Whereas it's like really easy to be like, America is good, or we got to talk about justice. But it really matters how we like whether schools will be open in the fall. Like that seems quite consequential.
Yes. And it also says something that it's not impossible, but it's often difficult to sort of talk about those things at the same time in a way that gives them an appropriate weight. I don't want to turn this into a critique of the media.
No, we should. The media is it's garbage.
Well, but I think that when education, as you say, it has to fight for attention. Some people in the education field don't want it to get a lot of national attention, frankly. But often when it does, right, reporters feel most comfortable talking about it as part of the contours of a national political debate and like what groups are involved with supporting this and who's funding it. But I was at an event where, you know, the last, sort of last question about this topic was like, well, you know, sort of educator focused, like what can they do? Like what are next steps when you're dealing with the controversy, right? And so one of my points was, yeah, I think there are political forces at play here and people are looking for leverage. And Virginia is sort of a proving ground for this because it has off year elections and it's right next to the Beltway and all this stuff. But I said, you know, if you're an educator or a school board member and you're dealing with this, might not be the best strategy to say to members of the public, hey, you're being manipulated by broader political force. And this is all about the Koch brothers or the Heritage Foundation. Those people are playing you. Probably that's sort of an obvious point I'm making, but I also like in terms of how this impacts educators and how they have to deal with it, might not be helpful for many of them to sort of say, well, this is the point that national stories are making about this. And so I'm just going to pick that up and use it when I'm dealing with the public. And I don't know if many or any educators are taking that approach per se on the ground. But, you know, I think that's something to consider, too. You can't put it back in the bottle with these sorts of arguments. I don't know how long this is going to last. The impacts of the pandemic could easily outlast this controversy. I think many people think that it will. And so what are we left with after that?
You know, one thing I feel like in the Virginia context, you know, where this has gotten sort of ripest is that, you know, conservatives have started telling people that you should look for these like code words, right? And so like anything that mentions racial equity, you know, like is a sign that like secret critical race theory is happening.
Right. Use your decoder ring and it'll tell you that, yes.
I mean, I'm being pejorative. It's not totally crazy because like it is true that what happens is that like communities of practice develop distinctive terminology. And it is true in particular, just like the use of the word equity to mean a particular kind of thing is probably a sign that, like, you have been talking to some left-wing people about stuff. It comes out of left-wing political circles. At the same time, like, the phenomenon that it refers to is something that conservatives have been talking about for a long time, right? Like, conservatives forever have been critiquing public schools and saying that, like, well, they're not doing a good job of educating Black and Latino kids, and, like, this is a big problem, and, like, this was George W. Bush's whole thing. It was, like, Trump's stated rationale for school choice at the beginning of his term. You're right that, like, teachers probably shouldn't scold parents and say, like, well, you're being manipulated. But it is also true that, like, you can get people really spun up about stuff such that, like, it's true, like, every school district in America is going to have some kind of an equity program, quote unquote. But, like, I don't know, that's just, like, the word they tell you to use in education schools.
Well, I think beyond education schools, I think it's also the Obama administration, you know, talked about it a lot. And so was the Biden administration, for that matter. And I think that, you know, you mentioned conservatives, they like to talk about opportunity. Right. How do we create more opportunity? And that's a different concept than equity. You create more opportunities through greater school choice. But opportunity isn't about outputs per se, necessarily or naturally, right? And equity is about inputs in a lot of cases, whether we're talking about funding or whether we're talking about, you know, how we view different learning opportunities. You know, a lot of the concern about equity in schools, for example, deals with, sure, the school might be, you know, socioeconomically integrated, but are a lot of Black kids taking advanced coursework? Is it all white kids? You know, that's an issue of equity. So it's hard to disprove people who are saying all these other words that you use are really just sort of a stalking horse or an alias for what is essentially critical race theory. And to the extent you can't disprove that, I mean, what are people supposed to do? You know, I was talking with Kentucky's education commissioner about this, and he said, look, we're not functioning as the sort of legal defense team for critical race theory. That's not our job. And, you know, he made it clear he didn't want it to be his job. But he also said, look, we are going to defend what we do on equity, and that's, you know, that involves racial equity. And I wonder to what extent concerns about equity, you know, there's a lot of research about how the public views things that they see as zero sum, right? If someone is winning, someone else is losing, that makes it much harder to advance something. And I wonder if equity has sort of been inflected with that. Like, well, that means someone else's kid is winning and your kid is somehow losing, right? That's very general, but maybe there's some of that at work too.
Well, and I do think this is where you go to something that is more tangible and real than some of this, like, what can you teach in the classroom, which is that, you know, there have been a lot of controversies where people will look at, okay, who's in the gifted and talented program? Who's in the special high school, you know, where you need to get a high test score to go in, stuff like that. And people look at it, and it's usually disproportionately white and Asian kids are in these programs. And then you have critics who say, from an equity standpoint, we either need to get rid of things that have that kind of disparate impact, or we need to change the standards. You know, we need to do something to increase diversity. And that, like, actually is zero sum, right? Like, you know, if you're saying, okay, we need to get more people from certain groups into this school, then, like, fewer people from other groups are going to be in. And that's tough politics.
That's tough politics. And, you know, I think you might see some of the same people involved in, you know, fighting that stuff in Northern Virginia, for example, involved in some of this anti-critical race theory stuff, right? I don't think that's much of a stretch, but I think that's a whole different complicated issue. And, you know, to a certain extent, I think that select high schools are not sort of a broad national education issue in many states. But I do think that what's going on now is sort of a version of that, where, you know, you sort people into, in the views of these legislators, you don't want people sorted into oppressed and oppressor. That's very black and white. That's zero sum. And so that's good politics when you're bringing that type of stuff up, like these kids are winning and these kids are losing.
I mean, that's kind of like the journey we've taken in this podcast, right? Like A Nation at Risk, No Child Left Behind, like all that stuff, right? That's about like positive sum, right? Like we will be stronger. You go back to like Sputnik, right? And it's like, uh-oh, like America needs like better schools, right?
The Russians are ahead.
Yeah, you know, or the Chinese are going to get us now, right? So it's like, look, we are all better off if kids learn more in school, right? That's going to be a stronger economy, a stronger nation. That's like benefit, benefit, benefit. Then there's like you zoom to the micro and it's like, okay, I've got a kid. I want him to get into like the best program, the best high school, the best college. But other people want that for their kids. And like that's zero sum, right? Like that's a nasty kind of knife fight. And depending on like what mode we're in and we like reason about education, you can have very different kinds of takes, right? As to like what's actually important here.
Yeah. And I think, you know, about almost 40 years ago, there was a fight in West Virginia about textbooks involving like, hey, let's bring in Allen Ginsberg and Malcolm X. And people were firebombing schools. The KKK showed up. People were praying for death for the board members who were on a certain side. This stuff is tough. And I'm not suggesting that we're heading in that direction where people are trying to blow up school buildings. But this stuff is difficult. And I think that there's like, hey, let's focus on the instrumentality of schools. And like, this is not it. But, you know, again, I do think that people view this as an important function for schools. In terms of what they try to tell kids about their role as citizens and how they should understand this country. That's inevitable, right? We're not going to not have history classes, right? So it's sort of like, because that won't help you get a good job. You know, so we're going to have these history classes. What do we do about it? And how do we describe the Alamo, right? Which has been a huge controversy in Texas. You know, so I understand sort of the idea of like, hey, we used to have this talk about measuring students' growth on these important topics. And now this feels way out of left field. But I also think it's part of a recurring and important debate. You can't avoid it. Like you can't wall schools off from it. Now, again, as you've been saying, this is like something that might feel strange or novel to a lot of people in terms of how it's coming up. But, you know, I think if you listen to educators, they're saying, hey, this is going to make my job more difficult, or I'm not sure how to navigate this. And that's something that people should care about when people with important jobs, you know, in public service are saying this could be tough. And, you know, several of these bills have been pre-filed for next year. So I don't think this is going away in a flash. So we'll see how that goes.
All right. I think that's a great place to leave it. And I will let you move on with your busy day of discussing critical race theory with many audiences, I understand it. So thank you so much, Andrew Jafusa. Thanks, as always, to our sponsors, our producer, Eric Tanakis, and the Weeds will be back on Tuesday.